And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm. Gee, it must be great riding with him.
Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
So you're at the hideout, you've done this first performance, you've turned the audience around, most especially the girls in the audience, which I found fascinating as a conversation about gender and expectation and societal expectations. But within three songs, you turn them around. But just to clarify, you and Susie were originally Coachette girls there. You're seeing all these bands who want to impress Dave Leone. He puts you on. You've impressed Dave Leone. He now continues to book you. And looking at some old advertisements, which we will share, you were one of the two featured bands a year later at the first anniversary of The Hideout. So, but did you continue to work there as Coachette girls? I know that's a silly question. I'm just curious. Or were you?
I'm sure we did, but it probably was mixed up with when we could rehearse. I mean, we could only rehearse after school and on the weekends because we were in high school. So, you know, it would have depended. I mean, I'm sure he had some other people working too. It might have gone by the wayside. That's like, I can't remember whether we actually kept working the coat room once we were really going with the band.
And did he, or, well, let me say that differently. Did Dave Leone ever pay you or any of the bands, or was it just the ability to have exposure as a band?
Oh, he paid his bands, yeah.
He did. Paid you as well, even when you were in
New York? He paid everybody, yeah. I mean, the local bands, well, yeah, they had to make some money. You know, I'm sure it was tiny amount, but he did that. Yeah, he was fair about it.
Well, and so was your brother, and they were friends when your brother started booking gigs. So, and I really appreciate that for both of them. So, okay, so let's continue on. After you have your gig at the Hideout, we've been talking about these major epiphanies for you personally, Patty, but also for the pleasure seekers and also for the world culturally, country and the world. But I just want you to set the time frame for us because there's another epiphany that you have also during 1964. And I just want to make sure I get it right and that the audience hears it correctly. So you've seen the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That's winter 1964. The Hideout opens up in the spring of 1964, May. That goes through you seeing the Beatles live at Olympia Stadium. So when did you play the Hideout? That must have been a little bit after, or am I wrong? And then we have an epiphany which caps off the year so magically that I can't wait to hear you tell this story because this is like music mythical lore. Like, how does this happen? So, but start with the timing of all of this, with seeing the Beatles, the Hideout, and then tell us about this next epiphany.
Okay, well, oddly, and this is a mystery that is in the rock ether, between seeing the Beatles and having our tryout in October, at the end of September, this producer from England, John Rhys Edens, comes walking into the Ball's basement. And this is like, what? And he
Well, hold
wants to
on.
record us. He's with Golden World.
Before you go on, because I want to take a deep breath here, because I want people to also, this is again, geography matters. You're in a suburb of Detroit. You are living it, you're there in Grosse Pointe. You're rehearsing in Nan and Mary Lou Ball's basement. You've only just seen the Beatles. You've only just had the phone call with Susie and Mary Lou and Diane and Nan, and you're going to form the Pleasure Seekers and you're working as co-check girls. So set the stage because I've driven down Tory Road, which is where all of you lived. And this is not a street that people just walk down. This isn't Sunset Boulevard.
Well, we'll never know how it happened. I've explored it in my memories, and none of us remember, but we were maybe have learned six or seven, maybe 10 songs by then. It was like 2 to 3 weeks, at the end of September when he comes into the basement. We don't know how he heard about us. It was like a shocker. And he already had creds. He came from England to New York, and then they opened Golden World in Detroit. And Golden World was later bought by Motown because Berry Gordy was jealous of the sounds that Golden World was getting on their production. It was interesting, but they were there in Detroit.
So this is John Rhys Edens,
Yes.
and who is Dennis Coffey, and were they in
Oh.
partnership together? So these two show up in your basement. And again, I want all the details. So did you
Yes.
know who they were when they showed up?
No, we had no idea. John was he also later recorded Edwin Starr, and he recorded SRC, and he recorded Terry Knight and the Pack, which was GFR, Grand Funk. He recorded them the first time and joined Capitol later. He had a lot of creds. He was a musician, a composer, and a producer, and an engineer. So he was working it in Detroit. And he shows up with Dennis Coffey. Dennis Coffey was a famous Motown studio musician and artist. He wrote a big hit song called Scorpio. And he has his own legacy. If you looked him up on Google, you'd see he played on so many albums. And you got to remember, Golden World existed, Motown existed. And as those two intermingled and mixed, a whole bunch of subsidiaries came in, Tamla and all these other ones in Detroit. It was bubbling up the same as the talent was. So I'm sure they were out looking for new talent all the time. Well, who can we record? And here's this girl band. What a novelty. There was no girl band. So we were like, my God, imagine we're 14 and 16 and 17 for Dan and Diane. And this guy comes in, a professional producer, and wants to take us into the studio, of which we had no experience at all.
Well, let me just add to that because both of these men also were PR aficionados. They saw marketing. So yes, an all-female band was a complete novelty. But let's add to the mix, you're all very good looking and you were good enough at that moment, right? And you went on to become amazing. But at the moment, with just these six cover songs that you were learning, you were good enough for them to say, yep, let's bring them into the studio. So did you have to play the songs for them? Did they sit down and did you have to audition or just?
I think we knew one of them that Mary Lou could sing. I told you earlier that sometimes we did a girl song just because Mary Lou had that kind of voice, but that we really went to the male-oriented type songs. So, I'm sure we had a confab about the whole thing and we probably knew the one that they wanted to record. They said, yeah, let's do that as a cover. And then Dennis Coffey got it in his mind to...
Hold on, because you're jumping ahead and it's too exciting to jump ahead. So
Okay. You
say that Mary Lou has more of a, I don't want to say girly vocal style, but
yeah,
more of a...
she did.
So I should never presume with you, but you say you had six cover songs that you played for them or however many you did. Was one of them He's So Fine? Because that is the cover song by
the
Chiffons.
I'm sure it must have been. I'm sure okay. It must have been. And they liked it and said, okay, let's do that one.
Right.
And then we had to come off with a B-side, you know, another one.
Great. Okay. So before we go on with the original, so that's a cover song, but one thing for the audience or the listeners to know as we're talking about this, unfortunately, we do not have the recordings of this. However, Patty, you are going to read us the lyrics and I hope sing for us. But before you do, tell us about Long White Line, how this came about. And this was all part of that initial meeting and then session in the recording studio. And again, you're 14, 16, and 17.
You know, I think at that time with girl groups and stuff, it was like this obsession to motorcycles and girls, you know, being a little tough and whatever. So I think Dennis got it in his mind, well, let's write a song. We helped him with it, and it was called Long White Line. And it was a motorcycle song. And the lyrics were made specifically for us. They're very cool. I know the whole melody, everything, but I would kill to have had a copy of that. We tried desperately to find it for years. We even had newspaper people in Detroit trying to find it in the archives. It was lost. I asked John Reese, do you still have it? No, you know, it's just too long ago. So it's lost in time, recorded and never put out. But we did smoke up the studio. John got it in his head to bring in a motorcycle and rev it up and stuff. And it started smoking up the whole studio. We had to run out and clear the studio. It was crazy. It was crazy.
Do you remember where the studio was?
They worked out of, I think the name was United Sound, and I'm not sure if that's where we went. I mean, obviously John had his affiliation with different places. He was moving and grooving. So it might have been United, but I can't remember. I know we were like, just, oh my God, we're going to make a record.
That's incredible. So he's smoking up the garage. And then tell us about the song. Tell us about the lyrics.
He's smoking up the studio, yes.
I apologize.
No, yeah, he smoked up the whole damn studio. So the song.
And the song.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can give it a try. I mean, I'm not 16-year-old Patty, but I can maybe sing one verse or something just to give you the gist of the melody.
Please
called
do.
White Line. Okay, here we go. Going down the highway, doing about 95. If there's a man who thinks he can catch me, you know he ain't alive. Gotta drive a sickle, gotta be faster than mine. Going down the highway along that long white line. And then the harmonies, white line. And we did, I told you the Quattros had great ideas on harmonies. We did this discord seventh harmony, which was our idea. Even at that age, it was long white line, all notes holding out, and it made this seventh harmony in between. It was very cool. And then it goes on with the, you know, gonna ride my cycle, drive it hard and fast. If there's a man who tries to outride me, maybe we can make it last. He's gotta match the fire, burning as fast as mine, gotta have desire to ride that long white line. And it goes on. I mean, there's two more verses. It was a very cool song.
Read the
was
two
written
more
just for
verses.
us.
Please read the two more verses.
Okay. Traveling every city, looking to find my home. If there's a town that shows me it can hold me, I'll no longer have to roam. A man who can possess me, living on the edge of time. He's got to see what I see down that long white line.
Wow.
And then the harmonies. And then the last one of the days are growing longer, riding a future past, looking for a man to take along that highway, someone who can make it last. Gotta drive a cycle, gotta be faster than mine, traveling down that highway along the long white line. It's a cool song. Lyrics
are really cool song.
Five girls.
It's perfect for five girls. And it just bears repeating one more time that you could have focused on being a girly band. You could have done nothing but crush songs on your boyfriend or whatever it is. And this is a real serious, tough song. It's a great precursor to What a Way to Die.
You know what it reminds me of, oddly, when I look back at these words? It reminds you of Susie's psychology and what she suffered her whole life, wanting to be someone, be tough. I'm going to make my mark. Because these words are like her type of talking.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah.
It's funny. That's such a great point. But I would add to what you would say that it's also the DNA of Detroit.
Yes. Tough, gritty, raw. It was a very raw song. Yeah.
Great. And since Dennis Coffey was helping to write the lyrics, mm-hmm. I think there was that infusion as well. I mean, it was raw. So question for you, speaking of Susie, did she sing these lyrics?
Yes. She was the singer on it. She sang it. Yep.
It was pressed, I'm assuming. There was a recording.
It was pressed. It was made. I don't know what happened in the interim. Well, it's lost. You know, we don't know. John couldn't even remember. The producer said, oh, my God. I mean, he was so, you know, having fun remembering it. He was at our induction into the Hall of Fame. And it was amazing to see him that many years later. It was great. And I said, and he remembered the smoking, the studio and the whole thing. But he couldn't remember the facts of where it disappeared to. And we did search archives and everything. It just disappeared. They couldn't find it. Their archives were a mess, I guess, you know, because it sold to Motown and things happened. Just history, you know.